I am Plato of the Line in Vancouver at thecommentary.ca. J.B. McKinnon joins me again. The critically acclaimed and best-selling author has a new book out, The Once and Future World, Nature as It Was, as It Is, as It Could Be. It's a contemplative look at the world and our place in it and our relationship to the environment. Our relationship with nature is something that we've either misunderstood, forgotten, or ignored. Mr. McKinnon does an elegant job at showing us what the world once was and what it ought to be. I'll get Mr. McKinnon to tell us about this book, how we ought to react to nature, and what rewilding is all about. J.B. McKinnon is an award-winning writer and journalist. He was last on the program 6 years ago when the book he co-authored with Alyssa Smith, The 100-Mile Diet, was published. It went on to become a bestseller, a television series, and influenced a lot of people's eating habits, least of all restaurant menus across the country and beyond. He won the Charles Taylor Prize for his first book, Dead Man in Paradise. He's also co-authored I Live Here, a paper documentary. The website for more is at jbmckinnon.com. This new book is published by Random House and was recently named a finalist for the Hillary Weston Writers Trust Prize. Please welcome back to the Plant on the Line program, J.B. McKinnon. Mr. McKinnon, good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
What do you think about when you think about nature? I mean, that's the question that you ask at the front of the book. I'm assuming that it's changed in the course of writing this book. I mean, you've realized that how you view nature has changed as well.
Yeah, I would say that I now see nature with much different eyes than I did at the outset of this process. And for me, as for many people, I mean, my baseline for what nature was and where I developed my idea of nature was in my childhood. And I was one of those kids who was lucky enough to be able to walk out my back door and into what I thought of as a wilderness, in a sense, grasslands that extended as far as a kid could want to walk. And in many ways, this book started with that. I ended up digging into the historical ecology, or what I think of more simply as just the history of nature on the landscape that I grew up in. And I found this incredible story of transformation and diminishment where, you know, for example, there were in the past elk and caribou and wolves and grizzly bears on this place that I grew up on that today has, you know, you're lucky to see a fox or a gopher snake. And so that was the beginning of my mind shift, in a sense, about what nature used to be versus what we call nature today.
Where did you grow up?
I grew up on the outskirts of Kamloops in the interior of BC.
I see. So what has happened in terms of our relationship to nature? And I mean, we certainly have had a hand in how nature has changed and how the land has changed. I mean, is there someone we can blame, something we could blame, perhaps, for you know, why it is what it is today and not what it was before?
Yeah, I think one of the things that I turned up through my research on this book that was most remarkable to me was that in many ways we can blame human memory. Not only have we been transforming nature because we are, you know, extracting resources and hunting to survive and all of these various things that we've done through time, but we've also been going through this steady process of forgetting what nature used to be, generation by generation. And this is this idea of shifting baseline syndrome, which is a term that was coined by a fishery scientist named Daniel Pauly. And it describes how each generation looks around themselves as, you know, in their youth and in their childhood, and sees that becomes their baseline state of nature. And then they measure any changes or diminishment to the natural world over their own lifetime. Then another generation comes along, and it resets what can be considered the normal state of nature. And then it continues generation by generation like that, with the result that over many generations, we really lose sight and forget what nature used to look like.
Why do we lose sight of the past?
It's an interesting psychological question, and really a lot of it has to do with the fact that nature is something that we think of as the background. It's, you know, what we remember tends to be the things that we have in focus and that draw our attention. And we psychologically, we tend to think of nature as the backdrop against which events play out, rather than an event in itself. So one of the things that's really remarkable about this is that the study of historical ecology is relatively recent. I mean, it was really only in the last 20 or 30 years that people started thinking that nature itself has a history rather than is the backdrop against which history plays out.
So what was happening in your life that got you to think all this? I mean, I remember hearing Paulie on, he used to appear on Rafe Mayer's show all the time, so I remember him. I think he talked about this once or twice, maybe. Were you just sitting around and then thinking about what happened and decided that let's put this in a book, or has this been something that you've been thinking about for a long time?
Yeah, I've been thinking about it for a long time. I think it's been accumulating in different observations through my life, but one of the most important was during the writing of the 100 Mile Diet, where I was sitting in Vancouver trying to draw all of my food and drink from the landscape around me, and I was constantly reminded that thousands of First Nations people did that in this place for millennia. And it was hard to see how that was possible, looking at the land and sea today. And at that time, I ended up looking back into, digging into old explorers' journals and pioneer diaries and old sea captains' log books and these sorts of documents. And it describes this world that is so dramatically different than what we think of as nature today, with millions of salmon charging up the Fraser River. Ulican spawning up the Fraser River, gigantic sturgeon, things that we just don't see today around us. And that was kind of the germ. And I sort of felt an attraction-repulsion to it, because on the one hand, it's depressing material in a sense. There's a sense of loss associated with it. But on the other hand, it's inspirational, because it tells us that we can work towards a version of nature that's much more exciting and abundant and rich than what we have around us today.
And that's what you call in the book rewilding?
That's right, yeah.
Is that a new term you've coined?
It's not a term that I've coined. No, it's a term that's been around not a very long time, but it's a term that's still kind of finding its way towards the definition. And the one that I am proposing is simply that rewilding is the act of making the world more wild. And it stands in, it's quite different in that sense from traditional conservation. Traditional conservation has tended to identify places that we think of as wild and then to try to separate those from human culture. And rewilding to me can happen at any level, anywhere on earth. It can happen in what we think of as wilderness areas today. It can happen in the heart of a city. It allows for a much broader spectrum of states of nature.
And but looking at the sea and land that surround us today suggests that we, I don't know if can we rewild? I mean, you talked about sturgeon and salmon. Their numbers have decreased over the years. I mean, does that, if we did rewild, does that mean that those numbers go up?
Yeah, ideally it does. I mean, I think when we look at the natural world as we knew it in the past, it allows us to set a higher bar for what nature should be. I think what it gives us is that opportunity to say the conditions we're living in today are not normal. This is an abnormal, simplified, diminished state of nature. And we may not have been aware of that. In fact, I would say that we are almost universally unaware of it. But if we can bring it into awareness, then I think we'll desire a richer state of nature around us and can start to turn our efforts toward that. We won't necessarily be able to remake nature exactly as it was in the past, and we certainly won't do so in every place on the landscape, but anywhere that we want to, we can start to make the world a wilder place.
And how do you do that, say, in the city that we live in, Vancouver? Say, in downtown Vancouver. I mean, you look at there are coyote sightings and the sort, and then people get hysterical about that. So how do you reconcile what we have, say, in urban centers like where we live, and the sort of rewilding that you'd like to see?
Well, in all cases, shifting baseline syndrome can work in reverse as well. Like right now, we've developed a culture that is so unfamiliar with nature that it seems intimidating to bring it back into contact with human culture. But that wouldn't be the case within a generation. You know, already I would say young people growing up in Vancouver are quite familiar with the idea of coyotes and might be at the point where, you know, which many people are, where they would they'd hate to see them go and would miss them if they did. And there are all kinds of different opportunities. You don't have to go straight to, you know, bringing grizzly bears back to the edge of town. It can be as simple as, you know, dimming more of the lights in the downtown core so that we can encourage more birds to migrate and to survive their migration through the city. It can mean bringing back to the daylight some of the salmon streams that used to exist in Vancouver. There were 120 kilometers of salmon streams within Vancouver city limits in the historical past, and you know, almost none are still free flowing, and even fewer than that have any salmon run at all. So those are it's not difficult to imagine with the kind of design and landscape architecture work that we're capable of today that we could have a thriving salmon run running through the heart of a city like Vancouver, certainly through its neighborhoods.
And I can start by at home when I come home at night and it's dark and it's raining. To be careful and not see when I see slugs or snails or worms on the sidewalk, not to step on them, right?
I suppose that's true. I mean, it's one of these things where where we have to develop a reconnection to the natural world in order to appreciate it and to make it meaningful to us again. And when we do that, and I kind of walk myself through a series of experiments in reconnection, when we do that, the city starts to appear to be a lonely place, in a sense. Cities are designed for one species, and that's the human species. And yet there are so many other species that could live among and alongside us that would enrich our experience of nature in a day-to-day way, with the result that we would get all of those benefits that are associated with spending time in nature, you know, without always having to take a long weekend to do it.
Did you say earlier that it'll take more than a generation?
Oh, sure. I mean, traditional conservation had its roots a long time ago, and I could certainly say that the entire 20th century was the golden age of traditional conservation. I think we're really right at the dawn of a rewilding age, and it will certainly take decades and decades for us to explore the possibilities of that. I mean, right now, it may seem unimaginable to even bring an animal like the beaver back into a city, but it's certainly something that's relatively simple to achieve if it becomes something that people value and something that people desire, and a choice, really, that people can express about how they want to live.
Isn't that happening at Stanley Park now? Didn't they spot a beaver recently?
Yeah, there actually are beavers in Stanley Park. A couple of them that have moved in.
Oh, really?
And there was one that showed up, and this one I actually thought was an interesting kind of talking point, because a beaver moved into an artificial wetland down in the Olympic Village earlier this year, and seemed quite prepared to live among us, except that the wetland really wasn't a large enough habitat for a beaver, so it stuck around for a week or so and moved on. And it raises the question of, well, you know, suppose we had built just a slightly larger artificial wetland with the idea in mind that a beaver might live in it. So, you know, we'd surely have a beaver there. And the presence of that beaver delighted a lot of people. I mean, this is something, very clearly, that many people enjoy having access to, and yet we've created this artificial division between human culture and nature that is preventing us from all of the benefits that nature provides.
Now, one of the fascinating things that you talk about in the book are these extinct species. There's no chance that those could come back if we tried, or can they?
Well, there's certainly quite a lot of talk right now about bringing back extinct species through cloning, and I'm of mixed minds about it. I mean, I think that there's so much opportunity to remake nature based on what we have here today that we maybe don't need to be investing man on the moon scale resources into bringing back the woolly mammoth. But if that is something that could get people excited enough about the idea of rewilding, then, you know, maybe it would be worth doing it. If it was the kind of thing that could really shift the way people think about what nature can be, then perhaps it is worth pursuing.
Let's suppose that on my block where I live, I'm the only person that's taken to your message and that's hip to what you've written in this book, but everybody else on the block is indifferent or against it. I'd say more indifferent than against it. One gets weary and thinks, well, that I can't really do anything. I mean, how do you get over that sort of apathy?
I mean, there's already plenty of opportunity to get involved. You may not be able to convert your block. But you may even in your backyard, rewilding can be as simple as hanging up a correctly built and properly placed birdhouse. There are species like mason bees that ecological restorationists are trying to encourage. It's a native pollinator in the city of Vancouver. There are things like that you can buy mason bee homes that will help bring those species back to life. But more importantly, there are a lot of community organizations in any city you want to go to that are already hard at work trying to do ecological restoration and projects of the type that I would describe as rewilding. And they really just need so much more public support and so much more volunteer involvement. And it reminds me in that sense of the local food movement. I mean, when Elise and I wrote the 100 Mile Diet, we certainly didn't invent the local food movement. There was a lot of people hard at work at it, and they really just needed that shift in the public awareness and consciousness to turn it into a community priority.
So one person can overcome the psychological barrier, say, of the greater society?
One person in concert with many other people, I think, can, yeah. There's no shortage of people, I don't think, that, as I say, there are people already at work doing ecological restoration and rewilding. It's just that is not currently a social and community priority, but it certainly has the potential to do so with a heightened level of awareness. And I think, you know, I talk about the three R's of rewilding being remember, reconnect, and rewild. And the first thing we need to do is remember what nature used to be like in this place, because that is our greatest guide to what it could be like in the future. We need to reconnect with nature because that will make it meaningful enough and valuable enough to us that we'll actually want it around us in a more dramatic way. And you know, once we've done those two things, we can really get serious as a society about remaking a wilder world.
Now, the 100 Mile Diet struck a chord with a lot of people and inspired many. Is that what you'd like with this book, to sort of start a similar discussion or conversation on ourselves and the world as it could be?
Yeah, I certainly hope that it will spark a similar discussion. I don't think any idea... Plays out in the same way as any other idea, but it'll be interesting to see how this one rolls out. Rewilding doesn't have quite the same soundbite quality as you said at the start of this conversation. There's a contemplative aspect to this, and I think this book really rewards the reader who spends some time with it and thinks about the ideas in it, and allows those to shift the way they see the world and think about the world. It's not necessarily going to spark an overnight personal experiment like the 100-mile diet or a shift to local eating. It may take more the form of a building awareness.
Back to just the 100-mile diet for just a sec, because I remember when I talked to you about that, and I guess I talked to you a few months after it had come out, and it had already gotten a lot of buzz, a lot of attention. Looking back at it all, does it surprise you how the concept of it all took off as it has?
Yeah, I mean, certainly when I started out down that road, I had no idea, but it really has become one of the most optimistic experiences in my life, because it really did show me that if all it takes is a shift in the topic that's on focus in society, and you can see quite a rapid transformation. I don't think anyone would question the suggestion that the local food movement has changed the way we eat. I mean, it hasn't completely revolutionized every aspect of the way we eat, but in many places it has physically transformed the landscape. And that's very exciting. It's very exciting to realize that if enough people get excited about something at one time, then we really can see society suddenly shift in significant ways.
Are you hopeful that we will rewild?
Yeah, I mean, I don't think we have any option ultimately, but I certainly think that I'm very hopeful. I mean, I really think that this is the way forward for people who want to live in a world where there's more integration with nature. I think there's all kinds of signs that people are longing for that, but traditional conservation just isn't offering an answer to those people at this point. And rewilding, which can take place on any landscape, and is something where people can be more active and more hands-on, I think it really does hold hope for the next century.
James, it's been nice talking again. Good luck with this book, and congratulations on it, and good luck with the Writers Trust Prize that it's up for.
Thank you very much.
And also regards to Alyssa, I remember her in the 100-mile diet. You guys wrote it in one voice, if I recall, but I thought she was a lot of fun in the book.
Yeah, she's still a lot of fun.
JBMcKinnon.com is the website. The book is called The Once and Future World, Nature as It Was, as It Is, as It Could Be. It's from Random House. Its author, JB McKinnon, joined me on the line from here in Vancouver. I'm Joseph Ponto.